content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the June 2018 issue of Discover features two stories on Viagra for memory and a model of the Mississippi River, plus two longer stories on defibrillators and right-handedness. Where's that Viagra for memory? Nearly 20 years later, we're still searching for the little blue pill for learning. In June 2000, Discover published an article about how we could someday be speedier learners. Want to memorize a Shakespearean play? Just read it through once. Want to learn another language? Give yourself about a month. All this with the help of a memory-enhancing pill. At the center of the article, Smart Pills, How About a Little Viagra for Your Memory, was a protein called CREB, or cyclic AMP, response element binding protein. It works as an on switch in the brains of humans and many animals, promoting new connections between neurons to help build long-term memory. Scientists at New York's Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, featured in the 2000 article, were inspired by fruit flies. They had genetically engineered one group of the insects to produce high CREB levels and another to produce low levels. In a setup to test learning rates, high CREB flies knew, after one zap, to avoid a smell associated with getting shocked. The results led the team to consider possible brain gains in humans. At the time of our original coverage, researchers estimated human trials would start in 2 to 5 years. But those plans didn't quite pan out. Now, after almost 2 decades, several human trials of CREB-boosting drugs are finally underway. The most advanced treatments have passed the FDA's initial safety phase and are in proof-of-concept studies with humans, says Tim Tully, one of the scientists then with Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, who was featured in the story. Tully, who went to work at a pharma startup called DART Neuroscience, says the realistic timeline for FDA approval is another decade. I'm 63, so I'm really starting to get worried about this, he jokes. However, the treatment currently under development isn't targeting memory boosts, but rather brain trauma that stroke patients experience. Just as high CREB levels increased connections in the fruit flies, the protein could help stroke victims re-establish damaged or lost connections. Tully expects that, once they're available, results from human trials will be concrete evidence of the treatment's effectiveness. If the patient can move his arm again, he's moving his arm again, Tully says. You don't have to debate. A mighty model. Big science does the big river justice. In a cavernous building in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, just steps from the Mississippi River, environmental engineer Clint Wilson lifts a beaker filled with dark plastic crumbs. They look like black lava salt, but in this room, the granules are a stand-in for river sediment. The tiny particles are an essential part of the massive Lower Mississippi River physical model, a working, flowing simulation of the river. The model, bigger than 2 basketball courts, with bleachers, elicits gasps from first-time visitors. Carved into the surface of a huge white table is a precise recreation of 14,000 square miles of southeastern Louisiana, gleaned from more than 4 billion data points. A deep, winding channel crosses the entire model, representing 179 miles of the mighty Mississippi, from just south of Baton Rouge to the Delta. Projectors beam satellite views onto the table, turning the white surface into a photorealistic replica of the terrain, and real water moves the artificial sediment, mimicking how the river moves sand. Researchers are using this model to find ways to stem alarming land loss in the lower Louisiana Bayou. Nearly 1,900 square miles have disappeared since the 1930s, when hundreds of miles of levees went up in response to the Great Flood of 1927, one of the nation's worst. The river, before the levees were put in, acted like a garden hose that was left unchecked, says Jason Landclose, Deputy Executive Director of Louisiana's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, CPRA, which funded the model. The river would basically spray everywhere across the coast and deposit sediment, fresh water, and continue to build land on top of land. You put levees around the river system, and you have no more of that. The land washes away without constant replenishment from the Wild River. Another 2,250 square miles, or more, could drain away over the next 50 years. To help restore some of that lost land, CPRA has proposed 8 sediment diversion structures, high-tech gates in the water that would release slurries of replenishing soil into the bayou along the lower Mississippi. But where they should go is hard to pin down. This giant model will give researchers a powerful tool to understand river dynamics, sediment movement, and how planned diversion structures will affect one another. Though numerical models and computer simulations are valuable, the physical model generates a steady stream of data that fills in digital gaps. It allows CPRA to investigate different scenarios to see how the river responds, not just in 1 year, but really 5, 10, 25, 50 years into the future, says Wilson, the Louisiana State University professor who heads the research. Big as it is, the model is still just a small piece of a 50-year, multi-billion-dollar master plan for coastal restoration. Helping Hands. A middle-aged man collapses and, for 15 minutes, has no pulse. Can he return to life? Is there a doctor? The call rippled through the packed rush hour train soon after we had pulled away from the platform. Recalling false alarms on airplanes, usually fainting spells from too much alcohol and too little oxygen, I hesitated. But this was the 537 Express, not a plane. It could be something serious. I set my book down and stood up. Stepping down the aisle, I came to a ring of onlookers peering down at a middle-aged man slumped across two seats. He wore a creased, stylish shirt open at the collar. "Sir, are you okay?" I asked, jostling a shoulder. No response. I pressed two fingers on his neck. No pulse. I tore open his shirt, locked my hands over his sternum, and started chest compressions. But the angle was wrong. He needed to be horizontal on a flat surface for my compressions to be effective. Sliding him partially off the seat dropped his head like a trussed deer's. "Please hold the head," I urged a woman looking on. She cradled it, and we shimmied him lengthwise into the aisle and onto his back. With my hands on his chest, I locked my elbows and pushed down hard at a rate of 100 per minute, each time letting the chest fully re-expand. "Pull the emergency brake," someone shouted. The train shuddered to a stop. My focus stayed on the chest. Up, down, up, down. Do not stop. A man crouched across the aisle. "Want to switch?" he asked. "I'm a doctor." "Compressing a chest is hard work, best done in shifts." "Sure," I said. Leaning partly over one of the seats, he took over. From my angle, his hands seemed off the sternum. "Here, like this," I said, cupping his hands and shifting them over. "Keep the heels on top of each other. Make them a pile driver." He shot me a wry look. "What kind of doc?" I asked. "Hearts." "Oh, cardiologist?" "Cardiothoracic surgeon." "Ah," I grimaced. "Sorry." "No worries," he said, smiling. A third doc arrived. "I'm a dermatologist, but ER was my second choice," he said excitedly. He maneuvered to relieve the surgeon. A woman in the crowd spoke up. "I am an operating room nurse. Shouldn't you be doing mouth-to-mouth?" "We're okay," I told her. The man's face had lost color, but studies show that hands-only CPR moves enough air in and out of the lungs to sustain blood oxygen levels. Estimates vary, but a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that 61% of sudden cardiac arrests stem from ventricular fibrillation, or VFib, an electrical misfire sparked by diseased or stressed heart cells. A heart attack, which is a sudden blockage of blood flow in a coronary artery, is probably the most common cause of VFib, but many cases do not happen that way. VFib's random discharges trigger neighboring cells to fire chaotically rather than follow the heart's pacemaker cells. This sends out a steady beat of electrical impulses from their perch in the heart's right atrium. An automated external defibrillator, or AED, can remedy the situation. It delivers an electric charge that silences every cell simultaneously, allowing the pacemaker cells to fire first and regain control of the heartbeat. AEDs are ubiquitous in airports, train stations, and other public spaces. "We need your AED," I shouted at the conductor. "We don't have one," she hollered. Oh, Jesus, I thought. CPR generates roughly a third of the heart's normal output of oxygenated blood, and every minute of delay to defibrillation drops the odds of survival by 10%. We were already 6 minutes in. "Call 911. Get us back to the platform," I urged. Every year, 360,000 Americans suffer sudden cardiac arrest. Less than 10% survive. One of the wrenching aspects of being an emergency room doc is to restart a heart, only to have the patient never wake up because, before getting to the ER, the brain had been starved of oxygen. Even more tragic is that VFib is eminently treatable in public places. In Las Vegas casinos, people shocked in less than 3 minutes have a stunning 74% chance of survival. Sure, the world is not a casino festooned with defibrillators, but a lifeline exists between collapse and defibrillation. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. First proved effective in 1960, CPR included chest compressions plus mouth-to-mouth breathing. But evidence mounted that mouth-to-mouth was unnecessary. Besides, very few people will lock lips with a dead stranger. When done right, hands-only CPR is highly effective. In 2008, the American Heart Association upended dogma and endorsed CPR using only chest compression. The math is simple. Deprived of oxygen, a brain starts dying in 4 minutes. To generate oxygen for the brain, compressions must start immediately and continue non-stop until defibrillation. A study involving Phoenix emergency medical dispatchers showed that when they coached bystanders over the phone on CPR, compressions began on average 3.5 minutes after heart stoppage, rather than 4.5 minutes. Survival leaped. We had been doing CPR for 15 minutes when the train inched back into the platform. Grabbing limbs, we scooted him to the train's exit doors. Two paramedics met us and opened their portable defibrillator box. They applied the sticky pads to his chest, one to the upper right part and the other to the lower left part. The defibrillator's robot voice intoned, "Analyzing." 20 seconds later, "Shockable rhythm. Stand clear. Shock advised." One of the paramedics pressed a red button. The man's body jerked. I felt blind without a heart monitor to tell if the shock had worked. Following protocol, the paramedics resumed compressions for 2 more minutes. "Strong femoral pulse," the surgeon announced. Other paramedics wheeled in a stretcher. They strapped an oxygen mask to the man's face. He pinked up. My stomach clenched. Should we have given him mouth to mouth? Then the man's lips twitched. The signs of life were great to see. But even the most advanced care after cardiac arrest wasn't getting us those 15 minutes back, during which his brain might not have received enough oxygen to prevent brain damage. The medics hoisted him onto a stretcher. "No, wait. I don't want to go to the hospital." We all did double takes. The voice was coming from the stretcher. The man's eyes were open. "I'm okay. Why are you doing this?" he said through the oxygen mask. I've had patients wake up after being defibrillated in the ER, but never alert and talking right after bystander CPR. I was amazed. For 15 full minutes, the CPR had kept oxygenated blood flowing to his brain. Look, Ma, only hands. A thought struck me. When you're dead, nothing moves, so your body's organs and muscles consume almost no oxygen. The brain uses 20% of the oxygenated blood pumped by the heart, which means CPR's one-third output is plenty to keep the brain healthy. I touched his face as much to prove I wasn't dreaming as to soothe him. He just died, I said. You should do what the medics suggest. He blinked. What? Your heart stopped. We shocked you. The next day, I visited the man in his hospital room. Sitting up in his bed, he looked healthy and chipper. His wife and two grown children were sitting around his bed, looking relaxed. I came to apologize for the shirt, I said. He stared blankly, then, Oh, gosh, it's you. I have to give you a hug, I said. His wife's eyes welled up. Tests on him later showed no coronary artery blockages and healthy heart muscle. One of the mysteries of VFib is the frequent lack of an obvious trigger. The cardiologist's best guess was that scar tissue from a prior heart procedure had disrupted the man's electrical rhythm. 2 days later, to ward off a repeat performance, surgeons placed an automated implantable defibrillator in his chest. I called him 2 weeks after his surgery. I'm doing great. Back at work like nothing happened, he told me. All I remember is feeling queasy for a minute, then waking up. CPR is a way for thousands more who suffer cardiac arrest to have a chance of waking up too. Look, Ma, only hands. Was science wrong about being right? Handedness is an ancient trait, but researchers are rethinking its roots. Much of what defines us as a species is all in our heads. First and foremost, we've got these big, powerful brains and small faces tucked underneath a skull that expanded to house our most precious organ. There's another trait that researchers once assumed was a Homo sapiens hallmark, based in the brain, but most obvious in the upper limbs. 9 out of 10 humans are considered right-handed. It doesn't matter where you find them, humans have that ratio, says retired University of Kansas anthropologist David Frayer. Across history and geography, our species has shown remarkable consistency, and no other species appears so strongly biased toward right-handedness. The trait's emergence in our species alone, the thinking went, was yet another indication of our superiority, a preference controlled by the brain, and directly linked to our capacity for language and tool-making. No. As researchers have refined methods and unearthed new evidence, it seems much of what we thought we knew about handedness was anything but right. Fossils reveal that right-handedness goes much further back in our evolutionary story than once believed. Recent research has shown that handedness and language do not go hand in hand, at least in the way we once thought. And in 2017, neuroscientists suggested that the origin of handedness is not even in the brain. The fossil record of hominins, humans, our ancestors and closest evolutionary kin going back to the split from other primates about 7 million years ago, is mostly fragmentary, making it impossible to determine handedness by studying limb bones. In the 1980s, researchers analyzed stone tools, trying to gauge hand dominance from the direction the material was flaked or chipped. While initially promising, the idea proved unreliable. Then Frayer began to look at striations on Neanderthal teeth. These furrows appeared only on the outer faces of mostly the upper teeth, at the front of the mouth. One direction of diagonal marks, either from upper right to lower left, or upper left to lower right, would dominate. Individuals working with tough, fibrous material, Frayer reasoned, could have held it between their teeth and one hand. then used an edged stone tool to saw off a small piece with the other hand. Every now and then, the tool edge would hit, ouch, the outer face of the upper teeth. The angle of tool-on-tooth contact could tell researchers whether the individual was holding the tool in the right or left hand. And one of the nice things about looking at the scratches, says Freyer, is that you just have to have a single tooth. Freyer and his colleagues have been able to analyze samples from across our genus. The oldest specimen, 1.8 million years old, from Tanzania, belonged to H. habilis, the earliest member of the genus Homo, and at least four times older than our own species. In December, Freyer's team published a study in Evolutionary Anthropology that confirmed finding the same 9-to-1 ratio of handedness across the hominin fossil record as in modern human populations. It destroyed the idea that H. sapiens is uniquely right-handed. "We have 50 right-handers and 4 left-handers at last count," Freyer says of the ancient hominins studied. "You'd have to find a pile of left-handers at this point to make it 50-50. You know where you can find a pile of left-handers? Certain species of kangaroo. Recent research on a number of animals nixed the earlier notion that only humans have a species-wide bias toward handedness. Among chimps and other apes, however, handedness appears to vary based on the method of evaluation. Comparing humans and other species can be especially problematic. While researchers typically determine handedness in humans through self-reported surveys, which hand do you write with, for example, they often use observations of general behavior for other species. When we ask humans about hand dominance, we ask about tool use rather than, say, hugging or picking your nose, says Gillian Forster. As a comparative psychologist at Birkbeck, University of London, she studies both the evolutionary and developmental pathways to behaviors such as handedness. Forrester believes that the difference between testing methods across species may make humans appear more biased toward general right-handedness, beyond tool use, than we actually are. "Humans have more objects and are doing more object-driven things," Forrester says. "If we narrow down hand dominance in apes to tool use, we find apes are certainly significantly right-handed for tool use. In fact, animals as different as chickens and fish show preferences, if not for handedness per se, then for favoring the use of a particular side of the body for a particular task. Motor biases are seen throughout the animal world, all the way back to 500 million years ago and the emergence of vertebrates, and possibly even older than that," says Forster. "Favoring one side of a symmetrical body over the other for a particular task is linked to cerebral lateralization. Essentially, the left and right hemispheres of the brain divvy up processes for greater efficiency. Most researchers believe that lateralization explains how handedness arises, including our consistent 9-to-1 ratio of right-handedness. Lateralization is not unique to us, but there are characteristics of lateralization in humans that are unique," says Emory University archaeologist Dietrich Stout. "Lateralization is ancient, but we take it to the extreme." Stout, who studies the evolution of cognition and tool-making, cautions that terms such as right-handed may oversimplify the complex processes made possible through lateralization. "It's not like the right hand does everything and the left hand does nothing," Stout says. "It's not so much that we're right-handed as that we have a characteristic division of labor between the hands. The right hand may do much of the more noticeable work, such as writing or cutting up food, but the left hand is just as busy, often providing stability." Southpaws, if you're wondering how you and other lefties fit into this evolutionary picture, some of the researchers. Once thought to be an aberration potentially caused by brain damage at birth, left-handedness may be more benign. Says Freyer, "I don't think it's a pathology. It's part of a normal variation." And what does it mean to your brain to be left-handed? Maybe not as much as researchers once thought. You've probably heard the saying, since the right side of the brain controls the left side of the body, only lefties are in their right mind. Nope. We now know that handedness is not so closely correlated with how the brain's hemispheres divide tasks. A lot of people think, if I'm left-handed, my brain is reversed, says Forrester. But 70% of left-handers are identical in organization to right-handers. And although there's an evolutionary genetic component to it, Stout says, even the people who study the genetic basis of handedness don't really know how it happens. Forget headlines about finding the left-handed gene. Science has not reached a consensus about the role DNA plays in handedness, or even that it originates in the brain. Last year, one team concluded that handedness actually arises in the spinal cord. Previous research has shown that human embryos demonstrate a preference for moving the left or right hand as early as 8 weeks. Writing in the journal eLife in 2017, neuroscientists found that this preference appears to be seated in the spinal cord, which, at that developmental stage, is not even connected to the motor cortex, the brain's movement control center. The team found that these early signs of handedness appear to be linked to lopsided epigenetic activity, chemical changes that effectively turn certain genes on or off without altering the DNA sequence itself. The research is preliminary, however, and scientists have not identified what causes these epigenetic changes. Regardless of how 10% of us become left-handers, that minority has historically faced a range of superstitions and worse. Left-handedness has been falsely linked to evil, perversion, and criminality. People see this difference and think it must mean something. We're always trying to understand and to suppress differences, says Howard Kushner, a historian of science and medicine. Kushner's 2017 book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History, explores how studies associating left-handedness with a variety of mental conditions often fall apart under close scrutiny. But as the scientific view of left-handedness as a pathology has lost momentum, so too have claims that left-handers are, on average, more creative or more intelligent. That said, says Kushner, I hang around a lot of smart people, and the number of left-handers is always more than one would assume. It may have something to do with resilience. A lifetime of being seen as different and dealing with such indignities as right-handed scissors may make southpaws more adaptive, though we have yet to turn up hard evidence. Frayer notes that even with nearly 2 million years of hominin handedness in the fossil record, uncertainty about its causes and consequences remains. The key thing is that we know right-handedness is commonly found in all populations of our species, and that it differs from what we find in chimps. To go any further is risky. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.